When does a paradise become a prison?
I am very interested in the point at which, you know, an enclosed paradise-like garden becomes indistinguishable from a prison. And very often the people who are in that enclosed and privileged space find themselves confined by fear.
That's Lucy Hughes Hallett. She tells us about her novel, Peculiar Ground. Set on an English country estate, it travels between the centuries to examine the theme of putting walls up and breaking them down. Then, a novel examines the moral quandaries that arise in the wake of Hurricane Katrina.
I think that we do have these ideas that you can, you know, you can put on your Batman suit and go out there and do things for other people that will be incontrovertibly good. But often, and especially in the case of something as messy as this flood was, your assumption about what somebody else needs may take away their agency or may end up hurting them in the end.
That's Morgan Babst. Her best-selling novel is The Floating World, out from Algonquin Books. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Lucy Hughes Hallett had already achieved renown as a biographer when she decided to turn her literary talents to writing a novel. Author of an acclaimed biography of Gabrielle D'Annunzio, Hallett is adept at using history to illumine important lessons for today. Yet that wasn't her intention when she started her novel Peculiar Ground. Set on an English country estate in Oxfordshire and moving between 17th century Restoration England and the second half of the 20th century, Peculiar Ground tackles themes of class privilege, rebellion, and competing notions of our relationship to nature in a richly detailed, multi-voiced narrative. But then contemporary events caught up with some of the novel's major themes. As a review in The Guardian wrote, quote, Peculiar Ground is concerned with walls and borders and the significance of land, what it means to appropriate it, to enclose it, to fence certain people in or out, ideas that feel particularly pertinent in the present. The novel has been described by reviewers as subtle, compelling, and powerful. Lucy Hughes Hallett's previous books include her award-winning biography of Gabrielle D'Annunzio, The Pike, and two acclaimed cultural histories, Heroes and Cleopatra. Lucy Hughes Hallett, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, you published your first novel at the age of 65 after the huge success of your biography of the Italian poet and fascist Gabrielle D'Annunzio. That was called The Pike. This novel, The Peculiar Ground, what sparked the idea of writing a novel, and this one in particular?
Well, I've always enjoyed reading fiction, probably more than reading nonfiction, although I've spent a lot of my writing life writing biographies, cultural history, nonfiction of one kind or another. Actually, I think the question is not why did I write a novel now, it's why didn't I write a novel many years ago? That's the question I can't think of the answer to. But as soon as I started, I found that I was enjoying it tremendously. And although, of course, I had the days that all writers have of thinking, I don't know quite what to do next, it seemed to flow with great pleasure to me and I hope pleasure for the reader.
And so it does. And now this is a novel that is very much about boundaries and enclosures, about walls. First, give us the setting. It takes place in one setting, but in two different centuries, 300 years apart. First in Restoration England, and I think you're going to have to explain just a little bit about the Restoration for our American listeners. And then later on in 1961. So first just tell us about the actual setting of this novel.
Right. It's set in a big house, which I've called Witchwood, which is in fact based quite closely, not exactly, but nearly, on a big house and a private estate, which I knew well because my father was the manager of such an estate, and I grew up in a house on the edge of the deer park of this magnificent and beautiful and secluded place. And my family moved away, my father changed jobs when I was about 17. So it was my childhood home, and I was never able to go back to it. And I think that meant that it, that place and that situation has loomed very large in my imagination all through my life, and in my dreams, actually. I dream about it quite a lot. And I've thought about it, not often, you know, a very concentrated way, but it's been in the back of my mind, I suppose, throughout my life, this kind of lost domain. And, of course, as the child of an employee, I was on the outside there. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't living in the big house. I was living in a much smaller house on the estate. I was observing, from a child's point of view, the kind of life that was being carried on by the landowners and their friends and relations, and also, of course, by the workers on the estate, of whom my father was one. So it has a big sort of emotional charge for me because of my childhood memories. But also, it was obvious to me from quite early on in thinking about writing fiction that it made the most wonderful setting for a story, because, you know, a big private estate cut off from the rest of the world is very useful to a narrator, because you have a lot of people interacting in a confined space. It's a sort of set-apart world. So that's what drew me to the idea of writing a story set in this place. And then as for the time, the chronological arrangement, I started off in the 1660s. And in 1660, the Stuart monarchy was restored after a whole generation of civil war, during which the kings of England, I mean, first of all, Charles I was beheaded, and his son, the person who would become Charles II, was living in exile, fugitive, often in danger. And he came back to take the throne in 1660. And there's a general sort of idea in sort of popular culture that the Restoration was a time of great merriment, and the theatres reopened, the Puritans had closed them, but then the court was back in London, and there was the king. He was a very charismatic king, Charles II, with all his mistresses and his flourishing court. And it all looks like a lot of fun. But the truth is, of course, that this was a nation sort of wounded, damaged by a whole generation of civil war, during which families had been divided against themselves, brothers fighting against brothers, and so on and so forth. And still operating in the 1660s was a very active secret service. Everyone was being spied on, but by the secret service who were answerable to the crown, but also actually by other spies, kind of counter espionage, by the Puritans who still hoped to get rid of the monarchy again, so that beneath this sort of dazzling surface of sort of court entertainments and the returning royalist aristocrats rebuilding their houses, there was a lot of resentment and fear and a lot of secrets. You know, everyone had been involved on one side or the other of the civil wars, and all of a sudden the world had turned upside down, and things which might have seemed honourable back in the 1650s were suddenly things to be kept secret, and vice versa, things that had been very covert were now out in the open. So that was a very interesting period to play with. And of course, there are so many echoes between that period and the period of the Cold War, during which the 20th century part of the novel is set.
Yes, but draw those out a little bit.
Well, one theme that became immensely important and central to this novel is the idea of a wall. A wall which is both an enclosure, a way of keeping people in and keeping the people inside the wall safe and private, and preserving their privilege, their sense of being in a peculiar ground. And peculiar in the 17th century didn't mean weird and odd as it now does. It meant special, reserved, set apart, privileged in brief. And so, you know, walls protect those on the inside, but can also imprison them. And walls, of course, also keep outsiders out. And so in the 17th century, in my novel, a wall is being built around the deer park of this great house to keep in the deer and to keep out any intruders. And there's a sequence towards the end, which is set in the year 1665, which was the year of the Great Plague, when I think nearly a third of all Londoners died of the bubonic plague. It was one of the worst sort of outbreaks of disease in British history. And people, and this is, you know, this is true, this is historical fact, people fled from London. Nobody really quite understood how the infection was passed on, but they could all tell that it was dangerous to remain in the city. So the roads around London during that year were clogged with people trying to escape from danger. And in my story, some of them try to find a safe refuge in my fictional house or the estate of Wychwood, and they find that the gates are locked against them.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lucy Hughes Hallett about her novel Peculiar Ground. It's out from HarperCollins.
You know, interestingly enough, I'm currently reading Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe.
Well, yes, that's a great book.
Yeah, in which he describes how people fled. And then, of course, people were trying to flee over from East Germany into West Germany in 1961. And I have read that while you were writing this book, current events began to play a larger role in your consciousness, the connections between all these. What's your thought about these recurrent themes as they happen across the centuries and the decades?
Yes, it's true. And while I was writing the section on the refugees from the plague-ridden London, I was seeing in the newspapers and on television screens day after day after day, there were images of people walking, you know, big motorways, highways, absolutely clogged with people on foot, trying to walk up from southern Europe, out of Turkey, out of Syria, out of places even further afield, Afghanistan in some cases. They were trying to walk into northern Europe in the hope of finding a safe place to live. And, of course, barriers were being thrown up against them, in some cases notional, you know, abstract barriers, legal barriers, tougher immigration laws, but in some cases actual walls and fences. And of course, as I carried on writing and revising the book and after its publication talking about it, now of course there's an awful lot of the talk about a wall between the United States and Mexico. But I mean, this isn't new. There have been, you know, the Great Wall of China has been there a very long time. People have been building walls, literal or metaphorical, to try and keep out those who want to share in their prosperity. That's been going on throughout most of human history.
Yes, of course. And one point that you make in this book, and we should mention that the wall that we're talking about in the 17th century is being built by the gardener, John Norris, in Wychwood for the Earl of Woldingham. You make the point in the book that, is this a place of sanctuary or of internment?
Yes, and I am very interested in the point at which, you know, an enclosed paradise-like garden becomes indistinguishable from a prison. And very often the people who are in that enclosed and privileged space find themselves confined by fear. I was interested earlier this year, no, last year, I was talking about the book in India, in Calcutta. And in that part of India, there are some very rich people alongside some very poor people. And the rich tend to live in the outskirts of the city, in walled enclosures, kind of compounds with CCTV cameras and wire-topped walls and so forth. And they come out of those compounds only in their vast sort of SUV vehicles. And I didn't know about this, but as I was talking about my novel to a Bengali audience, they were all nodding their heads, and they were recognizing this phenomenon of the rich and privileged who enclose themselves and try and block out the what they perceive as a threat from the less privileged people elsewhere. And then they find that they're afraid to go out, so that they are actually confined in these kind of gilded palaces.
Now, you made the point before that families were riven by the Civil War. The family in this book as well, your novel Peculiar Ground, Lucy Hughes Hallett, is also riven. Lord Waldingham was a royalist. Is that the term?
Yes.
Okay, he was a royalist. He returned from exile to his estate, Wychwood. His own sister was of the other party. So tell us a little bit about the relationship between the two of them and, you know, without revealing too much of the plot, what the dynamic is.
Yes, well, the sister, whose daughter Cecily becomes a very important character in the novel, Lord Waldingham's sister, with her daughter Cecily, stayed behind when her brother went into exile, and she had married a slightly less kind of grand husband. He was a sort of middle-class man, and he was sympathetic with the parliamentarians. And she stayed put, and while she was in charge of the Great House of Wychwood, it became a kind of commune for the dissenters, for the Protestant dissenters, both in the sense of religion and also in terms of politics, people who rejected the Church of England and also rejected royalist politics. And this was something that happened in England in the 17th century, and the kind of the Cavaliers and Roundheads, as they're popularly known, they weren't neatly divided by class or by geographical origins or by city and country. It really was a matter of conviction. So that very often you did find people who were closely related who simply took different paths. And so, of course, the main narrative begins in 1663 after the return of the royalists. But, of course, the people who've been living there on the estate throughout the quarter of a century that of the Commonwealth, they're still there. So that one has this juxtaposition of people who have had very, very different experiences of the civil wars that have just ended. And that creates a lot of interesting tensions.
Another tension in this book, Lucy Hughes Hallett, and we're talking about your novel, Peculiar Ground, is between, I think, two different approaches to the idea of nature. One is, John Norris, a classic 17th century gardener. His idea of landscaping is very much about the idea of taming nature, whereas the dissenters seem much more open, and not just in the 17th century, but there is a similar dynamic going on in the 20th century. They seem to have a very different idea of nature and the relationship to it. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yes, well, they're living in the middle of a forest, and the estate of Wychwood, like the estate on which I grew up, contains a lot of untouched forest where trees which have been growing in the same place for maybe hundreds and hundreds of years. And there's an interesting balance between conservation and use of landscape, and that's something that's it's obviously a very important debate right now in our own times, but it's also something that I was interested to explore in this book. And I'm very moved by people who plant trees. I think there's something extraordinarily altruistic about planting trees which you personally will never see mature. And of course, the great landowners of the past and of the present when they're planting avenues across their land, they're doing it to a large extent in order to kind of aggrandize themselves and demonstrate their own wealth and power. But whether they intend to or not, they are also making a wonderful gift to posterity. So that was one thing I was interested in exploring. And I'm also interested that this is very true of the English landscape. It may be less so of the country in which you're sitting. But we think of the countryside as being somehow natural. And of course, there's very little natural countryside in our overcrowded country. All the what seem to be wild, green, beautiful spaces have been intensively used by humans for thousands of years. So even the kind of the bare hills have been grazed by sheep who have been brought there by shepherds. The interaction between human beings and the landscape is one that's perhaps a lot more complicated than a sort of easy sort of worship of nature quite takes account of.
There's also another contrast, which I think is between the idea of private property and the commons. And this gets to some of the notions of class that are in your novel, Peculiar Ground.
Yes, yes. I mean, the idea of land ownership is central to my story, actually. Who owns the land, or rather, whose is the land? Is the land the most properly said to belong to the people who have bought it or inherited it, or does it actually belong to the people who work it? And this is something, of course, that's been at the heart of a lot of kind of political disputes for centuries now. And I was very interested in writing about my 17th century characters by the fact that Lord Worldingham, as you say, has just come back from many years of exile. He's left the country when he was a small child, has just returned in middle age. He doesn't really know this land that he supposedly owns, whereas the people who work for him, the keepers, the foresters, the gardeners, the farm workers, they understand the land, they know its topography, they also understand the people who live in it, and there are a lot of secrets which are not known to Lord Worldingham but are known to pretty well everyone else on the place. And that's quite fun to play with. And there are some witches in this story, and of course witches in my fiction, as very often in the 17th century historical reality, and perhaps more recent historical reality, people who are suspected of witchcraft are in fact simply people who know a bit more than the other people around them, people who understand the plants, understand the medical properties of the plants and so forth. And so this idea that the land yields up secrets, it supports people, it provides livelihoods to people, and in some ways the person who's getting least benefit from it is the person who actually owns the title deeds to it, who owns it in the legal sense. All of that I find quite rich subject matter to play around with.
So you wrote a biography of Annunzio. He was a futurist. Is that what you would call him? He was a fascist?
Well, he was a contemporary of the futurists. He wasn't exactly one of them. But he was one of the generation of Italian thinkers who sort of paved the way for Mussolini and his fascists. And Annunzio was a brilliant poet and also a politician who at one stage in 1919, at the end of World War I, actually made himself dictator of a city-state in what is now Croatia. So he was one of the few literary figures who've ever really stepped outside of the library, outside the ivory tower, and had a real place on the kind of world's political stage.
Yes. Maybe one that one wishes he hadn't had. So you've written about him as a romantic. You know, there is a certain influence of romanticism in fascism. And in this book, in Peculiar Ground, there is the idea of tradition, of the traditional approach to the age-old relationship, human relationship to nature, versus a kind of commercialization of nature, which happens later on in the book in 1989 in the 20th century, where the estate becomes a commercial venture. So I wonder if you could, you know, say something of the notion of progress versus the value of tradition to us.
Yes, well, I'm thinking about D'Annunzio again. Certainly, when you say romantic, most people will hear that as being a positive term, that romanticism sounds like something attractive, something good. But in writing about D'Annunzio and his sort of progression from being a young romantic poet to being a kind of fascist political leader, I think that I was very interested to find that there is a very direct line linking early 19th century romantic thought with early 20th century politics, and I mean the politics of the most sort of abhorrent kind. And the thing is that when someone like John Keats says beauty is truth and truth is beauty, that is all you need to know, everyone tends to just swoon and think, oh, lovely, yes, beauty, truth, those are nice things, aren't they? But actually, if you listen to what's being said there, it's a terrifically dangerous idea. Beauty is not the same thing as truth. And certainly, if the Italian fascists in particular, it's not so true of movements elsewhere, including Germany, but for Italian fascists, style, what Keats would have called beauty, became everything and was treated as though it was almost synonymous with truth and indeed with virtue and goodness. And that's a very dangerous position. It's a romantic one, but it's not one that one really wants to kind of see pervading the political sphere. So those sort of ideas I've been playing around with in my nonfiction. And then when I got to writing this novel, I wanted to show rather than judge, so that I was looking at the tensions, the difficulties, the kind of ironies about, for instance, creating something beautiful, i.e. a beautiful house. And then when you've made this beautiful thing, either nobody sees it, or you open it to the public, at which point, you know, the lawns get trampled, the sense of exclusiveness goes. And so there are these endless contradictions and tensions. And one of the nice things about writing fiction, actually, is that I don't have to say, this is what I think. I just say, this is what happens. You think about it, you reader. Just one more thing I'd like to say, because we've been talking very, rather in a rather abstract way about the themes of the novel and its sort of intellectual content. But I would like to stress that it's a novel full of people. And those people are doing the things that people always do, like falling in love, sometimes with the right person, sometimes with the wrong person, and aging, dying, having babies, going to parties. So that I don't want your listeners to get the idea that this is all a whole load of theory without a lot of flesh on it. I think this is a book about human life.
Absolutely. But the ideas are also quite interesting.
Yes, yes.
Well, it's just been great to talk with you, Lucy Hughes Hallett, about your book, Peculiar Ground. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
In addition to Peculiar Ground, Lucy Hughes Hallett is also the author of the award-winning biography of Gabriel D'Annunzio, The Pike, and two other works of cultural history. Read an excerpt from Peculiar Ground at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Morgan Babs about her acclaimed novel, The Floating World. Stay tuned after the break.
Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear. The future was coming. And now it's here. They had to fix the levees, 'cause otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ, what would happen when the big one hit. But every year they cut the funding just a little more, so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said, now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted, inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, 'cause malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Hurricane Katrina was a natural disaster, but so much of the damage it caused was a result of human action or inaction. That's true on a large scale. Decisions about climate change, levee maintenance, and evacuation orders, for example, but also on an individual scale, as people tried to cope with the catastrophe unfolding around them with uneven results. Morgan Babs was a resident of New Orleans when Katrina threatened. She evacuated to New York City and stayed there for years before returning to New Orleans. Her novel, The Floating World, arose at least partly from her survivor's guilt for having escaped the deluge. Beautifully written, The Floating World examines a family, a grandfather, two parents, one white, one black, and two adult children, who each have a very different way of coping with a disaster. The Floating World is the Katrina story that needed to be told, one with a piercing, unforgettable loveliness and a vivid, intimate understanding of this particular place and its tangled past. Well, Morgan Babs, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
This is your first novel, The Floating World. It's about Hurricane Katrina. It takes place in 2005, a little bit during, but mostly in the several months aftermath of the storm. You're from New Orleans. You evacuated New Orleans less than 24 hours before Hurricane Katrina made landfall. And you've said that The Floating World is a story about what might have happened if some other version of you hadn't left. And I wonder what you mean by that.
I think a lot of us who evacuated in advance of the storm had some guilt about what happened to our neighbors and our friends who did stay. And one of my ways of dealing with that was to try to imagine as fully as possible what would have happened if I had stayed behind. What that experience that so many of my fellow New Orleanians had would have been like.
Let's talk a little bit about the characters. You have very vivid characters in this novel. Five of them are basically the protagonists. Let's start talking about Tess and Joe. They're an interracial couple. There's also their two adult daughters, Cora and Dell, and Joe's father, Vincent. But let's start with a couple, Tess and Joe.
So Joe is an artist. He comes from a long line of Creole artisans whose the family stretches back almost all the way to the foundation of the city. And he and Tess meet when they're both in New York in grad school. I think she's sitting on a tub in some tenement apartment playing with her jewelry. She is an uptown white woman who's a psychiatrist. And, you know, they get together, they fall in love. So Tess, like many of us, has failed to completely grapple with the complicated racial history of America and of New Orleans. And I think in the aftermath of the storm, which brought up for us so many of those things that we had, you know, failed to reconcile, she decides to escape. She tries to escape her marriage, tries to escape into the safety of her privilege. And this obviously has terrible consequences for her relationship with her husband.
There's a very striking moment in the book, just to kind of linger on this point for a moment, where she's reflecting on something Joe has told her about. We should just say that they had to leave one of their daughters, that's Cora, in New Orleans while the storm was going on. In other words, she did not evacuate with them, and they're quite worried about her. Joe goes back to New Orleans to try to find their daughter Cora after the storm, and he's stopped by the police, and it's quite a tense moment. He turns back. So tell us, first of all, why he turned back, and then what Tessa's reaction is to that later on when we hear her thinking about it.
I think Joe is the first one to like really understand what they have done by allowing Cora to stay behind. I mean, of course, she's an adult. They couldn't exactly force her into the car. But, you know, she's a pretty fragile person. And what happened here after the storm was something that even the strongest of us would have had a hard time coping with. So he goes back in as soon as he can, leaving Tess behind in his brother's house in Houston. And when he gets there, you know, there's a mandatory evacuation order in effect. And the National Guard were turning people around, sending people out, you know, after that initial period where nobody was allowed to leave, when we had, you know, policemen stationed on the bridges turning people back into the flooded city. So, I mean, he realizes that he's going to get himself in terrible, terrible trouble if he tries to defy the people who are in charge of enforcing the evacuation order, and he leaves again. He understands the implications of that because he's Black. And Tess doesn't get it. Tess just thinks that he's been a coward.
Yeah, I found that strange that after all these years of marriage, she would still not understand how her white privilege protects her, and his being Black, he is so vulnerable.
Yeah.
How is that in a relationship like that?
I think it's entirely possible for us to live in, you know, cocoons where even the people closest to us, the imbalance of power and the imbalance of privilege doesn't really come home to us until there's a moment of crisis. I think we've become hyper aware of this in recent years, largely thanks to the Black Lives Matter movement. But, you know, I think there are still a whole bunch of us living inside this dream of false equality.
Okay, so now let's go on to Cora and Del, the two adult daughters. One stayed in New Orleans during the storm. The other was in New York.
I wanted to have that dichotomy in the book of someone who has gone away and is sort of forced home by the storm, and the other who is ultimately forced away by it. You know, Del, I've said and before, is she has some of the only autobiographical scenes in the novel. After the storm, I sort of evacuated ultimately to New York, which is where I had, you know, the largest number of couches that I could sleep on amongst in the homes of all of my friends. And it was, New Orleans is a very tight-knit place. It can be hard to find, you know, your freedom here, especially as a young person. And so I think Del had gone away looking for that and then realizes that the pull of home is so strong, especially in the aftermath of a disaster, that she's got to go back. She's got to put on the mantle and take responsibility.
We'll come back to that point in a moment, but I want to just finish with these characters. Joe's father, Vincent, I found one of the most interesting. One of the most interesting of these characters. Tell us about him.
Vincent's funny. He really started the book for me. He was the first character who came to me, and he came to me with like a lot of force, very, very insistently. I was sitting on a hill in Prospect Park in Brooklyn with my scrap paper, which I like to write my first drafts on. And, you know, I started hearing the voice of this old man, and he's walking through the felled trees on the North Shore looking for his dog. And then he and I realized at the same time that the dog died in 1978. I think if I believed in ghosts, I would say that Vincent was a ghost. His voice was so incredibly present whenever I was writing him. So he's a craftsman. He is one of the best cabinet makers in the South, and he's suffering from advanced Lewy body dementia. So in that disease, your memories will come back to you and then disappear again. You'll often have hallucinations of loved ones or of past things. So, you know, as I wrote him, I realized how useful this was to the ideas of the book. to the thought that, you know, in the aftermath of this flood, we were going to lose so much of our physical heritage that we may well lose our memories too.
Do you think that's happened?
I think in some places and in some respects it has. You know, New Orleans is an incredibly, you know, I want to say conservative, not in a not necessarily in a political sense, though there is certainly an aspect of that, but we like to keep our history around as much of it as we possibly can, even though, you know, we are constantly being attacked by nature and by the forces of progress. So we've tried to maintain a lot of ourselves, but we are irrevocably changed after that storm. We lost entire neighborhoods, and they're really not going to come back.
And just kind of on this point, what's your take on how New Orleans has been gentrified? Because actually, you moved to New York, and now you're back in New Orleans. So talk about, you know, the remaking of New Orleans.
Yeah. I mean, it's so incredibly complex what's happened here after the storm. You know, as I said, we lost most of the Lower Ninth Ward, which was a cultural center. It was like our bone marrow. And New Orleans East has also been decimated. Meanwhile, so many people have moved back in or moved home and started little businesses and taken over entire neighborhoods. I mean, the Bywater is completely changed. The first time I drove back there after the gentrification process began, I had no idea where I was. And it's really frightening to think that the neighborhoods that remained intact after the storm are now being dismantled by the forces of gentrification. Of course, we needed some new blood and some new industry, but it's scary to watch the rapidness with which those neighborhoods where people, you know, lived and owned their homes are being overtaken.
Right. So now back to your novel, The Floating World, very acclaimed for a debut novel, certainly, Morgan Babst. So this family is in crisis, one that the storm has exacerbated, but not itself created. So tell us a little bit about how the crisis in the family, you know, has roots elsewhere, but it's exacerbated by the storm.
Yeah. I mean, as I was saying before, you know, there are these fissures, these cracks in the marriage, a failure between Joe and Tess to really understand one another, because there are things that they haven't dealt with, that they've swept under the rug or tried to ignore about, you know, their differing positions in the world. And, you know, and Cora herself has, you know, unresolved mental issues. Del has tried to deal with all this just by running away. Vincent is sick. But then, you know, as I think crises of all sorts do, when the storm comes, all of this stuff is floated up to the surface. It's sort of what happened in the city itself. I mean, the disaster was not a disaster that was only, you know, made of wind and rain. It was something that we should have seen coming, or that some of us had seen coming. I mean, there were Pulitzer Prize winning articles in the Times-Picayune about the levee system and its huge flaws, that it, you know, given any opportunity, the levees were going to break. But nothing was done about it. And then, you know, here comes the storm, and then they do break. And so, you know, I wanted the state of the family to mirror that catastrophe.
And Cora, as you mentioned, Cora is, you know, unstable herself. She's been struggling with what appears to be mental illness, at least seen through the lens of her mother's eyes. So she appears to be a victim, something the novel opens with, what's hinted at, a terrible event. We see a corpse. She's very traumatized and becomes very withdrawn. But then as the novel progresses, a totally different picture of her emerges, one in which she appears with much greater agency. So I wonder Is this a development? Is this just kind of like a photograph we're beginning to, you know, that's being developed that we're beginning to see now the clearer outlines of? Tell us about how you developed these two different sides of Cora's character.
Yeah, I mean, Cora's narrative is probably the most, you know, difficult to get a handle on in the book, because we start only with, you know, almost a dreamscape where she's sleepwalking. She goes off and finds the corpse of someone she knows in a house in the middle of the night. And then we don't hear from her again until the middle of the book. So all you're getting as the reader are the, you know, the points of view of, or the perspectives of all of her family members on her. And they have all this past and all of these preconceptions about what she is, how she will react to things, how she'll behave. But, you know, for her, she's still a person. She's trying to do her best with her life and whatever it gives her. And so when the storm comes after an initial moment of retreat, she tries to act. She tries to take this new opportunity to, you know, be something, do something else. And she goes out there with her friend Troy and saves a whole bunch of people. But, you know, whether you can save everyone is, I think, one of the biggest questions that she and the book are left with.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say this on the air, so I'll use another word. But, you know, someone says in the book that help gets you forked. And, you know, I had to think about that, delve a little deeper into that idea of saving people. You know, you can't save people, kind of our ideas of what, you know, what heroism is all about.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we do have these ideas that you can, you know, you can put on your Batman suit and go out there and make decisions and make and do things for other people that will be incontrovertibly good. You know, and sometimes there are things that we can do that are incontrovertibly good. But often, and especially in the case of something as messy as this flood was, your assumption about what somebody else needs or what you can do for them may take away their agency or may end up hurting them in the end. I mean, obviously, there were thousands of heroes here, real, real heroes. And we needed an enormous amount of help, and we received it from so many quarters, and we are infinitely and forever grateful to that. But I did want to make it a little bit more complicated. And, you know, there's the idea of, you know, even the levees themselves, which are, you know, supposedly protecting us, but they also make it possible for us to live here 9 feet below sea level. They make it possible for us to be completely, you know, flooded. So, you know, I think that it's always important to think about the infinite complexity of anything, even the idea of helping.
And I wonder if some of those thoughts came as a result of the survivor's guilt that you alluded to earlier.
Yeah, probably. The book was 700 pages in manuscript. I was obviously trying to unravel all of these complicated feelings that I was having in the aftermath of the storm through these 5 to 7 characters, including, you know, the character who we see dead on the first page, who is the person who said that, you know, help is forking, which is, you know, possibly a completely crazy thought, but examining it felt right to me.
In fact, you have talked about, not in these words, I don't have your words right in front of me on that, but that each character kind of represented a parallel, or you could even say a therapeutic doppelganger to you. So how are Tess and Joe one part of you, and Cora and Del another, and even Vincent?
Yeah, even Vincent. I mean, Vincent apparently is part of me. Apparently I have a really old guy living inside my head and complaining about IKEA furniture all the time. But it's something that I do in a lot of my fiction, where if, you know, there's a really complicated emotional experience that I want to explore, I break it up into pieces and I give each piece to a character. So, you know, Del has my anger and Cora has my depression and despair. Vincent, I don't know what Vincent has, my crotchetiness. Tess has this desire to run away, and also this desire to explain things away. And Joe has this, you know, frustrated need to care for other people, because he keeps trying, Joe does, and he keeps on being stymied.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Morgan Babst about her acclaimed new novel, a debut novel, The Floating World. Now, the descriptions of the hurricane and its aftermath are so vivid. I mean, you weren't there during the storm, but I'm sure you talked to a lot of people who were. So where did you get that vividness of description?
In the aftermath, I was occasionally here. I would say that I was back probably for a week every month or so for the entire period of my, as I like to call it, my exile, I guess, when I was 11 years in New York. So, you know, I did see that terrible black mud that was dried out and cracked all over the sidewalks and the city in its state of ruin. The hurricane itself, yeah, I heard many, many, many stories. I mean, it's hard not to hear a Katrina story in New Orleans. I mean, even now, like, you can barely get a drink without having the bartender tell you what happened to them 12 years ago. It's, you know, it's sort of the citywide PTSD. So the stories are told and retold and told again. And of course, I had also, you know, I had been here for a lot of tropical storms and minor hurricanes during the course of my life. Katrina was the first one that anyone in my family had ever evacuated for.
You say PTSD. I wonder what was your reaction? I mean, were you there when hurricanes Harvey and Maria and Ivan, was it, happened this summer?
Yeah. There was a particularly strange moment during Hurricane Harvey. Many of the people in New Orleans had evacuated to Houston for Katrina. And so watching Houston fill like a bowl, the way we had sat in Houston watching New Orleans fill like a bowl, was particularly surreal. There were snippets of Harvey coming towards New Orleans on the 12th anniversary of Katrina this year. And we woke up that morning to torrential rain and to flash flood warnings, and all the schools were closed. And, you know, nothing ended up happening, but almost everybody stayed home that day. You know, I kind of joked that the mayor had all given us a mental health day to just sit on our sofas and, you know, deal with the reenactment of this thing that was now happening to the people who had helped us.
It came to me in the character of Vincent and his relationship with his granddaughter, Del, that you're saying something about the old traditions, the old ways of doing things, kind of the world that human beings have been so used to inhabit before this age of complete chaos, including climate chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about, I don't even know if that was in your mind, you know, climate chaos versus, you know, traditional cabinet making, but it seemed like there was a sense of the old ways that are so comfortable, and now we can't expect anything to be comfortable again.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I don't think that I had thought of it in exactly those terms, though obviously I was thinking about climate chaos and the writing of this book. And I do think that in some ways, the story that takes place between Vincent and Del, where Del had wanted, as you know, as a child, to be her grandfather's apprentice, to learn the cabinet making traditions that he had carried, and become, you know, the next in a line of, you know, many, many, many Boitarais who had made fine things with their hands. I was thinking about the fact that, you know, in the aftermath of something like this, when so many of our old things, in which so many of our memories live, were destroyed, and it was difficult to find people who could even repair them, much less build them again, that in departing from those old ways of doing things with your hands, doing things with attention and care, we were maybe putting ourselves in peril, or putting our putting the quality, at least, of our life in peril, if not our life itself. So yeah, in the end, Dell sort of decides to, you know, come back home and come back to those older ways of doing things. You know, I think sometimes we have a utopian idea of the past when, of course, you know, there was an enormous amount of like human suffering that went into building our most beautiful structures and our, you know, in the country itself. But I do wonder if in this era of electronic everything and manufactured, pre-assembled, throwaway things, if we aren't losing a sense of the importance of things and the care that it takes to maintain our world.
Yeah, exactly. That there is a connection between paying attention to, you know, the quality of our life. And if we don't do that, then we lose track of what's happening to us.
Yeah.
Well, Morgan Babst, this was just a terrific novel, The Floating World, and a terrific conversation. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Morgan Babst. The Floating World is her debut novel. It was a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and was named a Best Book of 2017. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt. Finally, we have a little time left, enough time for a poem. Here's Muriel Rukeyser reading her poem, The Speaking Tree.
This poem is called The Speaking Tree and goes with a legend of an island to which came Alexander the Great. The Speaking Tree. Great Alexander sailing was from his true course turned by a young wind from a cloud in Asia, moving like a most recognizable, most silvery woman. Tall Alexander to the island came. The small breeze blew behind his turning head. He walked the foam of ripples into this scene. The trunk of the speaking tree looks like a tree trunk until you look again. Then people and animals are ripening on the branches. The broad leaves are leaves. Pale horses, sharp, fine foxes blossom. The red rabbit falls ready and running. The trunk coils, turns, snakes, fishes. Now the ripe people fall and run, three of them in their shore dance, flames that stand where reeds are creatures and the foam is flame. Stiff Alexander stands. He cannot turn, but he is free to turn. This is the speaking tree. It calls your name. It tells us what we mean.
That was Muriel Rukeyser reading her poem, The Speaking Tree. Thanks to the Poetry Foundation for that audio. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.